Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. Hi, everybody. I am coming up now on 7 months of hosting this podcast. I hope you enjoy it. Please rate, review, and share the podcast if you like it so I can get more people exposed to the podcast. You can do this on Apple, iTunes, Stitcher, different other mediums where the podcast is, like Google Play. Please share it on social media and enjoy my next guest. My next guest is Darren Pepper. Darren is a school district superintendent, speaker, author, and consultant focused on what matters most in leadership. Darren's an expert in school culture and climate, as well as coaching and growing emerging leaders. He is known for his keen insight, culture-first leadership style, and dynamic personality. In 2016, Darren was named Wyoming Secondary School Principal of the Year by WASSP and ASSP, and was the 2015 Johnston's Renaissance Educator of the Year. In 2017, Darren earned his doctorate degree in educational leadership from the University of Wyoming. This past summer, Darren was inducted into the Johnston's Renaissance Hall of Fame. Darren shares his experiences from over 25 years in education, specifically those learned as an educational leader during the past 13 years. As a recovering high school principal, Darren talks about lessons learned and effective strategies to help leaders of all experience levels become more effective at their craft. Welcome to the podcast, Darren.
Thank you so much. It's exciting to have a chance to be here.
Well, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Oh, boy. You know, there's a number of these. And when you first shared with me that this is going to be one of the questions, I kind of struggled to narrow it down to one. You know, I think probably the best example, you know, really being in the trenches and having to kind of work my way out of a struggle would be when I was a high school principal. I actually, in the time that I was a high school principal, I had three different superintendents. Mm-hmm. And each time I felt like there was kind of the getting lost deep in the trenches and having to kind of scaffold my way out. And in each of the three cases, it was very different. With my first superintendent, I had been the assistant principal in the building where I became principal. And in that role, I was in charge of anything to do with instruction that happened in the classroom. And the thing that he had told me the most was, I want you to be the instructional leader of the building. And I already was. And so I really struggled with, well, what does that mean in this new role? And how do I best facilitate my three assistant principals to ensure that their work is meaningful and allows them to grow and advance in their career? When we transitioned to the second superintendent after my first one retired, it was someone who came from a very large system, mm-hmm. wanted to make a lot of very rapid changes. And it was very, very difficult. And now it wasn't really focusing on myself. It was, how do I help everybody else maintain balance, continue to focus in the direction that we had established as a school that we really wanted to go, when we had someone making just these massive sweeping changes in a very, very, you know, quick period of time. And then the next transition would be moving to that third superintendent who mm-hmm. tried to kind of bring calm out of the storm, mm-hmm. and being able to take where we were as a school and really move ourselves forward. We were really focused on increasing our graduation rate and like most schools, you know, always improving student outcomes. And the work I really had to do at that point while maintaining that was to rebuild a lot of culture that unfortunately had been torn down mm-hmm. in the period of time that second superintendent was there. So now I could give you tons of different examples, but mm-hmm. but those three just kind of jump out because it was you know, something that, even though it was a transition from one superintendent to another, each time it was dramatically different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you talked a little bit also in your book and on our pre-chat about your transition from being an AP in that same building to being a principal. And you're right how, you know, it was 40 feet or down the hallway, but it might as well have been 200 miles or something like that. So
it was, that was a very interesting time for me. You know, first off, I had just started my doctorate degree, coursework, like 6 months before I became the principal, which that's not necessarily a good idea. But I didn't know that that was when that was going to happen, of course. And then, moving from one office to the other, 40 feet down the hallway, it might as well have been 400 miles because, what I thought, the change in the two roles would be, and what it actually was, were two very, very different things.
Mm-hmm. So elaborate a little bit on just the expectations of the first school that you led and how you managed to bring your own ideas into the culture. You talk a lot about that in your book, The Road to Awesome, and you have a lot of pictures about examples of, you know, just displaying student work and tell me a little bit about, you know, how you were able to have both students and staffalty, as you call them, take pride in the school.
That's an interesting thing to reflect on. And definitely I hit that pretty heavy in the book. As I went through the process, when I first came to that school, my job when I came there was to be in charge of discipline and attendance. Mm-hmm. And I had this group of teachers who just, they wanted me to just bring the hammer. And boy, you know, if we focus on punishment to gain compliance, then we'll get what we want. And first of all, that does not work, nor should it ever be anybody's actual strategy. It just flat doesn't work. And unfortunately, I fell right into that culture in that first year. And It was partway through that first year, we were having a staff meeting, and I talk about this at length in the book. And actually, I think this is where, for me, the road to awesome actually started. Mm-hmm. In this particular staff meeting, we were talking about what are we going to do with hats and cell phones. And unfortunately, I think there are still schools around the country who have this conversation annually. And we were somewhere between have them put their cell phones in the little calculator thingies, and if you just smash one to oblivion, they'll all get the message. When a social worker in the room named Spring raised her hand, and she hit me with two questions that just, I mean, they just rocked me right back onto my heels. And they were just back to back. And it was, why does it always have to be about what they do wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Followed very quickly by, why can't it be about what they do right? And in that moment, there were a handful through the room who I think felt the same way I did. And then there were a handful who were indifferent and some who were like, oh boy, here we go, you know, flowery social worker kind of thing. But that's not what it was at all. It was, we really need to take a look at our culture and what we see in our culture. And what I now reflect upon was we were all about catching people doing things wrong, whether that was our kids or it was our adults. The phrase that was used by our leadership team, there were four of us on the leadership team, was, I'm going to ding that kid, or I'm going to ding that teacher. And it was never about growing. It was never about being supportive. It was about just control. And after that meeting, I had a conversation with our principal, and I just said, you know, we got a problem with our school culture. And he said, I know, but I really don't quite know what those steps are. Do you have a plan? And that's honestly where Jocelyn's Renaissance came into my life and really, really changed me. It started becoming about what were the things that people were doing right, and let's shine the spotlight on those things as opposed to always putting the spotlight on negative behaviors and on poor grades and on poor attendance. We were able to shift over a period of time dramatically in the first couple of years. And then in the 11 years that I was there, quite substantially, from a graduation rate under 70% to the high mark when I was there was 84%. Mm-hmm. and then attendance rate that was also 84%. But for attendance rate, that's not a good number, to well into the mid 90s when I left. And the focus was just, let's recognize, let's reward, let's reinforce the things that we truly value. And I think that was probably the most important work that we did, was let's take a step back and talk about what is important to us. What do we truly value? And let's start really putting the spotlight where it belongs. And that work carried me, you know, all the way through my time at that high school, and continues here in the district where I'm a superintendent. And by no means here was the culture as broken as it was there when I first arrived here. Good, strong community, very small school district, but still we had some work to do around really building that culture that recognizes, reinforces, and rewards everyone, not just a select few.
Yeah, that really shines. I, you know, mentioned a little bit about when you Google your school district and on the superintendent's page, there's a video there that Justin's Renaissance helped make, and there's a song. And if you can tell me a little bit about just kind of how, what came about and when that song was written and who wrote it and performed it. And it shows a lot about the school culture. And I think it's about a 3.5-minute video.
It is, and it's not one that I can take any credit for, other than a lot of the video shot was shot at my high school. The song itself was actually a poem first and turned into a song by some folks at Jocelyn's Renaissance. The poem was written by a student. I don't recall where in the country the student was from, but it was a student who had attended the Renaissance conference and was part of another Renaissance school in the country, and had written that poem. And it's very, very powerful. I love that video for a number of reasons, part of which is that my high school, where I was the principal at the time, is featured quite a bit in that video. Most of the rally shots and shots in costumes and some of those kinds of things were shot at my high school. But the thing about that song is that it really underlines what Jocelyn's Renaissance is about. And to be honest with you, a lot of what I'm about, in that we want to build connections with kids with their school. We know that kids are so much more significantly likely to be successful in school, to graduate, to go on to whatever their next step might be, whether that's college, trade school, directly into the workforce, if they have a significant connection in their school. And a lot of that, that video, that poem really just reinforces that importance of building connections and building relationships between students and staff faculty.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, such a powerful message to share. And a lot of what you've talked about in the book, and my previous question about, you know, the In the Trenches story about, you know, a lot of the schools, even today, you know, they're thinking about what can we catch kids doing wrong, right? And I know we're focusing now with, you know, reopening schools during the pandemic a lot more on social emotional learning. But I think that mindset of you know, getting rid of cell phones and, you know, seeing who's skipping class right out in the commons, or, you know, sweeps, tardy sweeps, those type of things, that's been a lot of the mindset of a lot of schools and leadership teams. And I think, you know, reading your book and adhering to this philosophy about, you know, having students and staff take pride in the school is, you know, what can really help the school culture turn around.
Oh, well, without question. And, you know, there's a lot of conversation, and has been for a number of years, but right now, I think coming out of the pandemic, I've heard it in a number of conversations, heard it on a lot of podcasts and so forth. I've said it several times too, that this is an opportunity for us to really change the face of education, and specifically in high schools. But we have to be willing to move away from that old model where we reward those who are only good at playing the game of school. And, you know, taking away cell phones, it used to make me laugh as a principal. I don't really see it much as a superintendent now, but in staff meetings, as a principal, my worst violators for sitting there in the staff meeting on their cell phones were the teachers who wanted me to, you know, take away a kid's birthday for having a cell phone. And yet, you know, there was this major disconnect between their behavior and the kid's behavior. And we can't look at the behavior of our kids, especially our high school kids, as, well, they're just, you know, they're just adorable, you know, little misguided kids. They're not. If we treat them like adults, if we give them opportunities like adults, if we give them leadership opportunities, it's incredible what kids are capable of doing. We just have to be willing to do it. Mm-hmm. There are several stories in the book, and I could share 10 or 12 of them just off the top of my head here, just from here in the last 6 months, mm-hmm. Where when we give kids an opportunity to do something, it's amazing what they're capable of doing. We just in our district, I'll tell you this one story as a simple example. In our district, over the course of the last year, the next step in our kind of our grand visioning project with our district was to create our profile of a learner. And in many cases, a profile of a learner, you know, or a profile of a graduate or something like that would just be done, you know, by a committee. Mm-hmm. Ours was done by our kids. Every single student at West Grand High School was involved in this process. Most of our students at West Grand Middle School were involved in this process. And then, of course, every staff faculty member in our district was involved, our entire board. Mm-hmm. But it goes specifically to the kids because on our profile, there are actually 8 puzzle pieces. Mm-hmm. And within the puzzle pieces are different symbols. And the one that I'll speak to specifically is in the puzzle piece that's titled Partners. And it's a hand pouring something into a cup. The idea there is to continually fill the cups of our learners. Mm-hmm. That came directly from a student who's a senior at West Grand High this year. He was the one who said, you know, we need others to continue to fill our cups so that we're able to go out and be successful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we give kids an opportunity, man, it's amazing what they'll bring to the table. So that's just one simple example.
Yeah, I mean, truly recognizing what their talents are and things that they have to bring to the table. And so often policies are decided upon, you know, these learner profile type things, curricula, it's decided upon by the adults, right? And you know, it's been so long since we were students, and having those students be a part of this decision process in your district is really amazing. Yeah. And, you know, then they're able to be much more involved in, you know, fulfilling the tasks needed to achieve higher grades. And, you know, they were a part of making that decision. So I think more and more as we move on from this pandemic and learn from you know, the changes in education are being made, that we need to really involve kids in those changes and those decisions and in policies and things like that. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your doctorate dissertation. And you mentioned earlier how you started your doctorate just right after you were only 6 months into it, correct? When you started your first principalship, and you said that you changed the topic during that principalship.
Yeah. So when I first entered the doctorate program, you know, at that time I was in charge of curriculum and instruction as an assistant principal in that particular building, and I was very interested in the processes that are used for implementation of technology in the classroom. And so as I went through this program, there were either 4 or 5 research courses that you took along the way. And each one, of course, you know, you're doing a fairly lengthy research project. And so all of my projects as I went through were specifically on, you know, implementation of instructional technology. And when my second superintendent came in, I mentioned that earlier, while there were struggles with that individual, one of the great things that he did do was acknowledge that he had never been a principal, that he had never been a classroom teacher. He came to be a superintendent through a business pathway, and he didn't feel that he was capable of or had the skill set to grow and, you know, to grow leaders, because that's not a role he'd held. So he connected all of us in the district with our own coach. So I had a principal coach who was from, actually from here in Colorado. I was in Wyoming at the time, but, as I got to work with him, it was one of the most powerful experiences that I ever had. It's also a big part of why I think coaching is so, so critical. And I think coaching gets bad rap, but I'll come back to that. So when I had the opportunity to work with this individual, his name is Tom, as my principal coach, it started to really kind of change some thinking in my head as I was going through and completing my doctoral program. And I had finished the coursework, and now it was, you know, time to write the dissertation and do the, you know, research, all that kind of stuff. And I found that I was not interested in my topic anymore. Not that instructional technology isn't interesting, it is, but my focus had shifted because I had seen how I grew and how then I was able to help others grow as a leader through leadership coaching. And so ultimately, it did take me a little bit longer. I probably could have graduated a year or two earlier, but kind of resetting my thinking around that dissertation topic. I wanted it to be something that was meaningful. And ultimately, I did change my topic and did my dissertation on the perception that Wyoming principals held of their own level of preparedness when they entered the job. So in their novice first 3 years, how well did they feel prepared in two particular areas, both instructional leadership and then also in operational management? For me, the big shift or the big reason for those two topics, I guess, is like I said earlier, when my first superintendent said, "I want you to be the instructional leader," I already was. I felt very prepared in that area. It was, in a lot of ways, a seamless transition. But on the operational side, everything to do with operational management, you know, budget and personnel and facilities and just on and on, I had zero experience there. And I was fortunate that I had a very, very talented administrative assistant who was very experienced and was able to help me in those areas. But you know, the operational management stuff, the day-to-day operations of the school that I had not been doing, I didn't have that skill set. And fortunately for me, having that leadership coach, he helped me kind of work through all of that, see really what was the big picture, and help me establish, I refer to it in the book as standing on the balcony. You know, what were the things that were truly important to me that I would go, you know, visually, and actually for me, it was physically, I went and stood on the gymnasium balcony. That was like my space, where I could look, you know, look down, if you will, and how am I doing in these particular areas? And so it was for, you know, for all of that, that I redirected my dissertation and, ultimately was very proud of the project, but, a lot of it had to do with finding something that was meaningful and that I was really passionate about.
Yeah, you talk a lot in the book about, you know, when you started that principalship and, you know, you wrote about kind of your feelings about, you know, you were hired to be a principal, so you should be the be all end all, right? And the knower of all things, right?
The biggest mistake a person can make. Yeah.
And that's true. I mean, there are many building leaders that haven't had experience with operational management. And like you mentioned, I mean, your coach helped you use your administrative assistant more to her capacity. Because a lot of the time, you know, administrative assistants have been there sometimes 25 years. Yeah. And they know a lot more about the building or the custodians as well than sometimes a new principal or even since you'd been an AP in that building, but you weren't running the operations. So
right. Yeah, there's no question that probably one of the biggest mistakes that young leaders make, and by young really I mean novice, you know, when you're early in your career, especially in the principalship role, you do, at least I did, and I've seen this in a number of other building principals that I've worked with, that I've coached, that, you know, I've done consulting work with. They get it in their heads. I got it in my head that I had to solve everybody's problems and I had to be like the purveyor of knowledge. apparently I didn't pay very close attention to the principal I worked under as an assistant principal, because Randy had it absolutely mapped out. He was very good at delegating each of, as he referred to them, our sandboxes. This is your sandbox. This is yours. The whole thing is mine. You know, stay in your sandbox. You can work, you know, you can work in other sandboxes. Just don't make a mess. he had it very, very well mapped out. And for whatever reason, I just went in with this belief that I had to do it all. And it really led to, I'll be honest with you, a messy first year. Mm-hmm. And over time, though, I was able to kind of reestablish, you know, what it was that was going to be effective as far as the leadership dynamic for the district or for the building. I actually was able to hire two new assistant principals, which made a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Bringing a team together and really getting moving forward. And I reinforce this all the time now with my leadership team here in my district, whether it's my HR director or one of my principals or one of my directors, that it's not our job to solve other people's problems. Mm-hmm. It's our job to help them solve their problems. Because if we just continue to solve their problems all the time, they're going to expect us to do that. Mm-hmm. And we need to, just like we need to do with our kids, we need to empower others to, you know, take control of their own journey and be able to solve their own problems. It doesn't mean we're not there to help them and to support them, but we can't do it all, because that definitely leads to burnout.
Yeah, correct. I'm interested in knowing one of those takeaways or ahas that you got from your research during your dissertation on what was something that they were mostly unprepared for as they entered the principalship.
You know, it was really interesting because I had this, and you try to set your biases aside, obviously, when you do that, but I had this belief and kind of this hypothesis that most would be like me, in that they really did not have the skill set to do the operational stuff. But really, it was a little bit more in the direction of folks felt pretty good with operational management, but really struggled inside that realm of instructional leadership around culture building, around being able to lead professional development. Mm-hmm. It was a really interesting mixed bag, which made me wonder, you know, is it the way that we prepare principals inside of districts, mm-hmm, that maybe is a flawed system, or is it the university system? Mm-hmm. Not certainly by no means to blame any universities, but, mm-hmm, you know, when you go through a university program, it's pretty spelled out. You know, you're going to take a class in, you know, in this. And I don't feel that my program prepared me at all to be a principal. Mm-hmm. I do think actually my doctoral program prepared me a whole lot better to be a superintendent. But when we see all of these different mixed results in just in my study, which was a fairly small study, it makes me wonder, you know, what is it that is the best thing to best prepare principals fully rounded, mm-hmm, you know, as they go into that experience? Because, you know, certainly you can grow and improve, and everybody's going to do that, hopefully. But boy, you don't want your first year to be a big rocky mess, because, mm-hmm, there was this void in your preparation, whether that's culture building or budget management or understanding facilities or whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, there are some principals that go into the job and they, you know, they completed the principal licensure program and they think they're set. But I think a lot of them, you know, are becoming more and more open to having that growth mindset by not only attending the conferences and listening to webinars, but also, you know, hiring some type of a leadership coach or, mm-hmm, you know, building upon extra certifications. I took instructional leadership certification through the Principal Center, you know, just learning of ways to better evaluate and give feedback to teachers, things like that. And, mm-hmm, you know, as you said, ways to fill those gaps that you don't necessarily learn. Like you're thinking about, you know, you take these courses, it's, yeah, kind of like when you're preparing to be a teacher, they don't tell you in your teacher program,
yeah,
you know, how to handle the irate parent, right? Or,
yeah,
you know, they don't tell you in the principal prep program how to handle a potential gas leak, right? Those types.
Oh yeah. No kidding. Yeah. I actually dealt with two gas leaks where we had to evacuate very large high school, like 325,000 square foot high school, wow. 1400 kids. And 2 days in a row, or well, 2 days, I think out of three, we evacuated in the dead of winter to the junior high down the hill, which was, I don't know, maybe a quarter, maybe a half of a mile walk, but we're evacuating, you know, kids who were in the pool, in their swimming course, and, you know, all these kinds of, yeah. And how do you reunify at this time? Well, before we were all quite well versed in reunification drills and stuff, it was, you know, parents coming and picking their kids up, and yeah, those kinds of things you were absolutely not prepared to handle. And, yeah. And you're right. There are more and more leaders out there now who are seeking those things out. There's more and more that are out there providing those types of services that, again, you know, I go back to that second superintendent I worked for. If he had not connected me with my leadership coach, I don't think I would have this book in my hand. That's for sure. I don't know that I would had some of the success that I've been able to have. It's so critical that we get that outside feedback and you know, have somebody who's done it, who's been there, but also isn't right there every single day with you. Can kind of stand on the balcony with you and say, you know, or, you know, and maybe to help listeners think of it a little bit differently, as opposed to being on the balcony, think about it, you know, as a coach. When I was a basketball coach, all of our region games were almost 3 hours away. I taught in Arizona. And so on the bus, the second we got back on the bus, I was watching tape, and the tape's up on the balcony. You know, I can see, you know, why are we making the mistakes we're making? What are the things we're doing well? What do I need to plan for tomorrow in practice? Mm-hmm. And having, you know, that camera was almost like having another coach for me, because I got to see those things independent of in the heat of the moment during a game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You started out in your book and talking about when you first met with him and he came to your school and you did walkthroughs and you were thinking like, well, I know how to do walkthroughs.
What are we doing? Yeah, I know.
Kind of, you wanted to hear what you saw in the classrooms versus what he saw. And that's such a growing opportunity, because it could be vastly different things. And you might not be looking for the right things when you're doing those walkthroughs. Right. I mean, a lot of principals and APs, you know, they think those such simple things, but getting a new perspective and a lens on that as well.
Yeah, it was, I'll never forget that day. You know, we before we even made it all the way to my office, I'd gotten bombarded with requests from teachers. I had some angry parents in the office, a bunch of requests from kids, which I never even got to that day. That still bothers me that I wasn't able to get that done that day. But Tom's like, okay, you know, grab a pad, let's go. I'm like, oh, cool. You know, what are we going to go do? And we start going into classrooms. And I'm like, Tom, I don't have time for walkthroughs right now. I got to do this and this and this and this and this. And he's like, you're not a firefighter. Mm-hmm. You're this school's leader. You got those assistant principals put out all those fires, put them to work on that. Mm-hmm. And we need to do this. And part of it was, yes, what are you seeing in the classroom? But I think there was this overarching piece too, that Tom just wanted me to take a step back and remember, if I'm going to be the leader of the school, if we are going to be successful, I have to spend my time on the things that are truly those levers that are going to improve student outcomes, which meant being in the classrooms, you know, not running around chasing down, you know, any manner of other things that my admin assistant, either of my three assistant principals, you know, my maintenance person, whatever, all of these folks could handle those things. And I needed to let them do their jobs, mm-hmm. which would allow me to really do mine.
Mm-hmm. You talked about, you know, kind of learning through those challenges as a building principal, led you to thinking about becoming a superintendent. So walk me a little bit through that process as to maybe how long you were thinking about taking that step, and then the application process. As far as I know, in Colorado, I only have a principal license, but they do have a separate superintendent's mm-hmm. license. And, you know, so kind of what was needed in order to, you know, get prepared to take on a superintendency?
You know, that's really an interesting question, and there's a lot of layers to it. You know, just simply from the licensing perspective, completing my doctorate degree in educational leadership more than qualified me for what I needed as far as licensure here in the state of Colorado, and the same in the state of Wyoming. It was a several year process for me. I had the good fortune of being my daughter's high school principal, and my wife and I had talked that, when the time came and she was going to graduate that, maybe we did want to look at that opportunity to step to the next level. The superintendent I worked for, where I was a high school principal, we're the same age, like 3 days apart. She's not going anywhere. She grew up there. She's not going anywhere. And I knew it was going to come in a different location. And I was okay with that. Loved the time that I was there, but it was time for a new challenge. And for a couple of years, I started to look at making that jump. And I thought, and I'll tell you this, there's multiple pathways to get to being a superintendent, but it was my belief that the only way to get there was to be applying for assistant superintendent positions, district level administrator roles. And for a couple of years, that's what I applied for. And it was just, boy, if the perfect position opens, I'd be willing to go. And when we got to my daughter's senior year, it was, let's expand the search a little bit. I applied for a couple positions in Wyoming and a couple positions in Colorado, and had a couple interviews. It was a very, very interesting process. Interesting to see how each district does it very different. Mm-hmm. I'll use Colorado as an example since we're both here. Some districts will use the State School Board Association, so CASB, as kind of their primary search engine. And other districts will say, no, we're going to post this our own way, and we're going to go independent. In the case of West Grand, they went independent of CASB. And ultimately, of course, you get to that point where the interview comes, that was a very interesting experience to have a chance in a couple of different communities to go get to know a little bit about the community, meet some of the people, see the challenges that each district presents, see the opportunities, see the successes that are already there. For me, and probably the best piece of advice I got as I was going through the process was from a fellow superintendent actually here in Colorado. He had told me, keep in mind that you're looking for fit. It isn't just about, the title of being a superintendent. It's about finding a place where it's going to fit kind of what your values are, what your goals are, and then also that you're going to fit the values and the goals of that particular district. Definitely a great learning opportunity for me. And now I'm in my fourth year here as a superintendent in this district. And it has been a great, great learning opportunity and a great opportunity to grow even further as a leader, because now I'm able to impact an entire system as opposed to impacting just one school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's so important for the superintendents to visit those communities. And you visited some schools in the communities as well and saw teachers in action and, mm-hmm. and did walkthroughs with principals, things like that. Yeah. So, I mean, it gives you really a picture of just, what you'd be walking into. And mm-hmm. I think that's so important. Superintendents are looking for a new job within the same state with districts that they know, or they're going across the United States. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, and right now, I think, we're at a point, with technology, with social media and so forth, that we're not just confined to a small area. Mm-hmm. Superintendents move all over the country. And based on a lot of different reasons, whatever their goals might be or what have you, but it is critical that, when you're looking to make that move and you have the opportunity to interview for one of those positions, to be a finalist in one of those positions, that you genuinely go and demonstrate interest in that community. There were, in this position, there were three of us that were finalists. One dropped out just a couple of days prior to our final interview. And of the two of us that were left standing, I spent 2 days in the community. That person drove in and drove right back out, the other person. And not saying that's why, but you know, that I got the position and that they didn't, but having the opportunity to spend a couple of days in the community, I'm certain I knew a whole lot more about the community, about the needs of the community. I got to know some of the kids, got to know some of the teachers. Yeah. And, you know, I think that goes a long way. I mean, if, you know, to me, it was about demonstrating and not putting on a show. It was just about demonstrating genuinely that I am all about relationships and I wanted to start building relationships right away.
Yeah, definitely. And that'll help also as you start a position, when the contract starts or even prior to the contract starting. And, you know, I've seen a lot of superintendents in the Denver, Colorado Springs area when they started and, you know, the past couple of years, and they have those, you know, the kind of coffee chats, you know, with the community. Mm-hmm. They set up different times to meet with community members. And I think that's so important because, you know, you're serving the whole community, not only the parents and the students in the buildings, but, you know, to make yourself available to go talk to anybody within the community that wants to find out more about you and your vision.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's essential that superintendents, and this I think is true of principals as well, we have to do everything we can to control the narrative about our schools and to tell the story of our schools. You know, all too often, I think the story of our schools get told by some test score or by some review that somebody leaves on Great Schools or something like that, whether that's positive or negative. When in reality, every school district in America has some amazing things happening. It's just whether or not we're willing to put the time in to telling that story. Mm-hmm. And if that means, you know, sitting and having coffee chats, I'll tell you, I jokingly refer to the coffee shop here in Kremling, Big Shooter's Coffee, as my office away from office. I am there all the time. That's where I like to have meetings. Not just because I really, really enjoy an Americano down there, but because so many people in our community are going to come and go. And to be honest with you, I think our community probably knows if I'm going to go look for Darren, that's where I'm going to go first, you know, because you're probably not going to find me in my office. I am in my office now, but usually I'm out and about in one of the buildings or I'm somewhere in the community. So the superintendents who are doing those kinds of things, that's the right work to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's transition a little bit into talking about your book and how long it took you to write the book and then, you know, when it got released. I think it was released pretty recently, and kind of, you know, the process of getting it published and, you know, tying it all together.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so I finished my dissertation. Actually, the day I got a phone call that I was a finalist for this position was the day I was defending my dissertation. Oh. And graduated the day after I interviewed here. Wow. And I would have sworn that day, if you had asked me if I'd ever write anything again, no, there's no way. I will never write anything again. About 6 months later, it was, you know, that passion for leadership and for growing leaders just continues to bubble to the front for me. And I remember telling my wife in January of 2018, I want to write a book. And she's like, okay, you know, what do you want to do with that? And I don't know. So it took quite a bit of time to, you know, I just knew I wanted to write a leadership book. And I knew I did not want to write the same canned book that a number of authors have written, which is do these things and I guarantee you'll be successful, because that's a struggle. There are a number of great leadership books out there that talk a lot about some great leadership strategies. There are some other books that are out there that, you know, don't necessarily tell you what to do, but provide a lot of great philosophical ideas. And I love those books, and I wanted to land somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And, unfortunately, the first year and a half that I was trying to develop writing a book, I could never get past about 1500 words. Mm-hmm. And I found that I just couldn't stand what I was writing. Mm-hmm. Because it was going in that direction of either, just do this or just don't do this. There was a lot of, you know, trying to, identify those things I'd seen in myself and in other leaders that wasn't successful. And I'm like, no, that's not really where I want to go. And then I just took a break from it. And then in January of this year, 2020, I kind of caught the fire again and started writing, and might have even been in December of 19. Just right around that holiday break time, I started writing again, and it started to kind of flow. And I was inspired by a friend of mine who's also an author, Jonathan Alsheimer, who wrote Next Level Teaching. He just gave me a little bit of advice and said, you know, you should really just reach out to a publisher, because, you know, if you can get something in the hands of a publisher, even if it's just a couple chapters or it's just an idea of what you want to write, then that's going to hold you accountable to getting moving. And I did. I reached out in February to a publisher and submitted three chapters a few weeks later. And that seemed to kind of hit a stall as I continued to write. And then I decided, you know, there are more publishers out there, so let's try another one. Mm-hmm. And submitted to Codebreaker, mm-hmm. Which is a publishing company in Ontario. And immediately got a response and submitted basically a finished draft. There were still some modifications left, but submitted essentially a full draft in April. Mm-hmm. And the very next day I had a publishing contract from them. And then we started the whole process, and you asked about the process, and holy cow, what a learning experience this was. especially, and you know, God love them, Brian Aspinall, who runs Codebreaker, and Daphne McMenemy, who's his editor. They run at one speed, and that speed is go, which was great, because we went from, you know, mid-April signing a book contract to July 1st, the book was live. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would have never guessed that it could happen that fast, but, you know, everything from the editing process to cover design, my cover, even though it's a photo, was designed by one of my students. It's another example, give your students an opportunity. A senior from a kid who graduated last year from our high school, has the, cover design credit, in my book, and, just a really interesting experience. And, now it continues to be an experience, you know, learning about continuing to advertise for the book and, you know, push it out there and let people know what it's all about.
Yeah, that's so impressive that you were able to, you know, get that off the ground once you picked it back up in December and wrote it throughout, you know, kind of finishing it during the pandemic and all these changes that were happening. Yeah. You know, contracting with that publisher and you know, as you said, they pushed you to just get that edited and get it off the ground. And I think it's a great, you know, it's kind of a guide. It's just, you know, like you said, you're kind of falling in the middle. It's talking about what you did and what your philosophy as a leader and, you know, sharing those experiences. And I think those are the best type of leadership books to read, because, you know, it's not so much a theory, but it's a practice. It's hearing what people have done and how they've been able to change things and move right.
Yeah. Well, and that, honestly, that was my goal. I mean, ultimately when the book started to fall together, and really just started to flow, wasn't just look, hey, here are the six things I think are most important in leadership. These are my six go on the balcony items, but rather frame that in the reader's head. And then that last chapter comes in as, okay, what's the most important thing for you as a leader? Don't worry about what's important for me. Don't go follow my formula. You need to have a formula, and you need to be then willing to, you know, go stand on the balcony or watch the tape or, you know, have a coach at your side or whatever that may be. And you know, if I've empowered some other leaders to maybe take a really good look at how they lead and how their leadership aligns to what they really value and what's important, then the book was a success.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you highlight on your website, you know, you've given keynotes and you've spoken at some different conferences, and
you
know, they've kind of come to a standstill right now. We've both spoken at the CASE conference, the Colorado Association of, what was it,
School executives.
Executives. Yeah. I wanted to say superintendents and educators.
Yeah.
But you know, so what do you mostly share about when you do those keynotes or breakout sessions?
Sure. So, the keynote that I've given the most, has evolved into Road to Awesome Leadership, which is really kind of a synopsis, at about a 30,000 foot view of the book, which, you know, focusing on what matters to you, you know, as far as your vision and your goals. And then, you know, the things that I spent a lot of time on with school culture, with empowering students and empowering adults and those types of things. The other keynote that I give, and this one goes as a breakout session quite a bit, is kind of a rapid fire ideas of here are some culture builders, some great things you can do that'll give you results right away, that you know, take them, run with them, modify them. But here's a bunch of game changers, if you will, that will help you build culture and climate or reinforce the culture you want in your school, in your district, whatever the case may be. And then in addition to that, sometimes some professional development workshops specific around leadership development, focusing on a myriad of different topics that I'll actually do, you know, in a kind of a customized way for whatever it is that the district or the client is looking for.
Mm-hmm. And so you're currently available for any districts or leaders that are wanting to reach out and, you know, get a little bit of, you know, tips and maybe PD workshops. You're doing that.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. It's something that certainly the pandemic has kind of put a little bit of it on hold. Can definitely do some things virtual. It's so much better to have an opportunity to go, especially when I'm consulting or coaching with leaders. It's great to have an opportunity to go spend time in their building, you know, walk with them, you know, kind of see the things that they're seeing, ask good questions, in a lot of ways, kind of mirror what Tom did for me many years ago, and help getting me focused on the right thing. But yes, I'm definitely available, and people can get to that through my website, which is roadtoawesome.net.
Okay, great. Well, as we come to an end of the podcast, out of everything we talked about today, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
Leadership matters. Bottom line, leadership matters. Right now, we're at a very critical time, not only in education, but a critical time in our country, in our state, in our communities, where leadership is so important. And specific to schools, leadership is the single most powerful lever we can press to make a difference in student outcomes. Great leadership is going to result in having not just one or two isolated great teachers, but an entire team full of great teachers, empowered teachers, teachers willing to take a risk, teachers who are willing to innovate and create. And when you have teachers who can do that, kids are going to emulate that too. So having great leaders in our schools and in our districts right now is absolutely essential, because leadership matters.
Right. That's so important to remember as we, you know, start the school year and, you know, go through any challenges that are going to probably arise throughout the school year.
We're all going to have them. Yeah.
Where can people reach you online? I know you mentioned your website, but you're also on social media as well.
Yeah, on all of the social media platforms. So my big three are Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I'm at Darren M. Peppard on all three platforms.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks so much, Dana. I really appreciate it. Have a Road to Awesome day.